Hey, 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 guys. Welcome to Building This Community.
This is your city business and policy development podcast. We're your hosts,
Luke Patrick
and Andrew Klump. Welcome to this week's episode of Building This Community. Our guest today is Councilman David James, who is the current president of the Louisville Metro Council and actually just announced his intent to run for mayor. Councilman David James, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing this morning?
Doing well, doing well. Thanks. Thanks so much for joining us. I gave a little bit of your background and what you're doing now, but can you just give us more of an overview of your career?
Yeah. So, you know, I was born here in Louisville and grew up initially in West Louisville on 43rd Street, moved to Shively, went to high school at Butler High School and went to the University of Louisville, joined the United States Army Reserves at the age of 18. I was an intelligence analyst there. And when I finished with that, joined the police department in 1984 and worked in the narcotics unit for about 14 years, served on the SWAT team, served as an instructor, served as the vice president and president of the FOP for a while. And then I left the police department to become the commissioner of investigations at the attorney general's office under Greg Stumbo. After that, I went to work at the University of Louisville Police Department as the major of operations for their police department. And in 2010, I got elected to the city council for Louisville Metro Government. And I've served as the president of the council for the last 4 years.
Well, that's a really impressive career trajectory. Again, we appreciate you coming on to talk to us today. But Councilman James, what do you feel are the issues, the type of issues that city government, specifically Metro Council, are best equipped to handle?
You know, I always try to tell people, and people have really started paying attention to what local government does and doesn't do since the tragic death of Breonna Taylor. And I always try to explain to people that there's a separation of powers between the executive branch and the legislative branch, and that the Metro Council can only legislate, and that the mayor is the executive branch. So the council makes the laws, passes the budget, and the mayor's duty is to execute those laws and to execute the operations of his office. And so I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. Well, I guess beyond that, like, are there any other constraints on the powers of the council? Like, based on like the organizational structure or like the state and federal laws that might supersede?
Yeah. So the other thing I would say is that Metro Council doesn't have the authority or power to hire or fire anybody. We don't negotiate labor contracts. None of those things. We don't have the authority to settle lawsuits that we get for liability. The only input the council has in a lawsuit is if it's a wage and hour lawsuit. Outside of that, it's all done through the executive branch. We are also limited or constrained, I guess, preempted is the word, by federal laws and state laws, especially state laws, on many, many different subjects. So I know that people think that the Metro Council is all powerful, but KRS 67C is the state law that created consolidated local government here in Louisville. And it was designed for a super strong mayor position, not a super strong council position. And so that's what we have here in Louisville.
Well, and to that a little bit, right? The way that this is set up is that what contains the mayor is almost the newspaper and the media as much as the Metro Council.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, the Metro Council typically only has the budgetary constraints and the ability to put in ordinances for the most
part. That's correct. That's it. You're absolutely correct.
So if that's the case, I guess one thing that we've talked about on the show a ton is how Louisville compete with peer cities. And we put ourselves up there with like Nashville and Cincinnati and Indianapolis, when maybe we should even be looking at smaller cities like a Raleigh or a Des Moines. What can Metro Council be doing to compete with our peer cities?
No, what I would say that Metro Council can do is make sure that the funds are available to have that competition, right? And what I mean by that is when the mayor decides what path the city is going to go down in order to compete against those cities. You think about Nashville, for example, 14 years ago, Louisville was dead even with Nashville, except for the mayor of Nashville at the time worked with the council and they decided they were going to go down a certain path and be bold and imaginative in how they were going to stick to a plan to raise up Nashville. And they did that. I mean, they even built an arena before they had a team. And so Louisville has not done that. And so the way that the council can help make sure that Louisville goes in that direction is to assist the mayor in doing that if the mayor so desires to do that.
Well, and is there a game plan that you think the mayor should take to whoever the mayor may be now or in the future that the mayor should take to help us compete with peer cities?
Absolutely. I think it's incumbent upon us to do several things. You know, we often talk about local option sales taxes and reimagining the tax code for the state of Kentucky, which also would include some sort of local option on the sales tax so that Louisville can compete to have the things that other cities have that we don't have currently. And so I think that's one of the major things that we have to do. And also, I think that it's important for whoever the mayor is to get together the stakeholders throughout the city and decide what we want our city to be known for, and then sell that and pitch that and intentionally make sure that we have a workforce that is available and prepared for companies that want to move in to our city. And it's also important that we make sure we support the businesses that are here and grow our own businesses with our local citizens. Many of our citizens, as soon as they get through college or high school, they leave to go to another city. And we have to make sure that we attract them to stay here. And so those are some of the things that are, I think are vital. You know, we have to set our sights on businesses that we want to have here in our city because it complements our city, and go after them intentionally and not just wait around for someone to show up.
Yeah, we've talked about that exodus of talent before, and I know there's a lot of different opinions on how to address it, but I kind of wanted to turn to a more specific issue area. And that's, we know that there are major thoroughfares throughout the city, you know, examples like Broadway or Market Street that aren't actually owned by the city, they're owned technically by the state, and they require transportation cabinet approval to alter. Do you think that that arrangement might inhibit growth in the city or kind of hinder us in other ways, like maybe our ability to improve our downtown area?
No, not really. The way that it currently works is if the city comes up with a plan or an idea, we simply go to KYTC, Kentucky Transportation Cabinet. Our local representative here is Matt Bullock, and he's been very cooperative about most all things the city wants to do with the roadways that are state roads.
Well, that's great to hear. I think that's something that's been surprising. I've been working with the Prosper Preston Group trying to get some work done here on Preston Highway, and seeing, I guess I just see from my perspective, it took an eternity for Dixie Highway to get redeveloped, and maybe that's just a slower process because there's additional arrangements for what we have to do. But it's good to hear that there's that good relationship.
Yeah, Dixie Highway also included a lot of federal money, too. So right. You got three layers of bureaucracy that you have to deal with there.
Right. So that actually leads into something that I hit on all the time in this podcast is the importance of accessibility. And so that's accessibility in food, accessibility in healthcare, accessibility in job opportunity. And I think that's integral to equity. How can you or Metro Council kind of create more accessibility for the underserved?
You know, I think a good example of that is what we did in last year's budget, which we're currently in right now, FY21's budget. We put in $3.5 million for community groceries to try and enhance accessibility to food. And I'm hoping that we'll have an announcement on where those groceries are going to be within the next month or so. We've been going through an RFP process with that. And so that's the address of the food. And then for healthcare, you know, we have our community health centers, and I think that's real important that we continue to support those and lift those up however we can. I forgot the other one. I think it was jobs. Is that?
Yeah, job opportunity.
Job opportunities. So, you know, in last year's budget also, we put just over $1 million in for opportunity youth, meaning youth between the ages of roughly 18 to 24 that have left high school or college, and they're not working anywhere, and they're not in a job training program or anything like that, to try and get them on their feet and into a job and prepared for a job. So we look at doing things like that. We also use Kentuckiana Works as a tool for lifting people up and job training and job preparation. And, you know, I have to celebrate JCPS and its academies program that it just started, focusing young people on particular career paths. And so I'm not saying that we're where we need to be, but we're going in a right direction.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So, and I'm going to give my quick plug too. You mentioned the dog earing money for grocery stores. So I've always been a big fan of the Louisville Community Grocery, and I actually became a member recently and helped draft the bylaws when I was in law school. I think what they're doing is unbelievable and will really, really help change communities. So I'm very glad to hear what Metro Council is doing with that. But related to accessibility a little bit, many people are, and rightly or wrongly, have blamed the Black Lives Matter protests or COVID around kind of downtown struggle in the last year. But in my opinion, I see suburban sprawl as maybe the issue that's been hampering downtown's growth for decades. What can Metro Council do to kind of encourage more growth of the urban core?
You know, I think the development of the urban core is vitally important to our city. You know, we have, you know, we financed the Omni Hotel, and we've got several condominium and apartment buildings that are in the works for downtown Louisville to try and bring more people to downtown. COVID has been a real game changer for cities all across our country and including ours. You know, when you have Humana and the major hotels only operating with just skeleton crews in their buildings, when those people are the lifeblood of the activity that takes place in downtown Louisville, you know, just simply when they go out to lunch, they create their own economy, right? And so also because of COVID, you don't have the conventions and the conferences coming to town. And so it has just really hampered downtown Louisville. And so I think that, and I hope that when we come out of the other side of COVID and the social unrest, that I look at that as an opportunity for Louisville to be real nimble and flexible in its rules and regulations as it relates to development, so that we can be the first out of the chute to explode and gain momentum as we come out of COVID and revitalize our downtown and our city.
Well, I guess that's just something that I see as a concern, is that we've seen people, you know, beyond COVID, right, that have moved out for the past decade or two decades to the East End or moved to Oldham County, even outside of the tax district. Is single family zoning in that? I mean, when people move outside further out, the businesses, you know, Churchill Downs, for example, is on Hurstbourne. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot of those suburban office places too. Do you think that is there a policy that could help bring more businesses back downtown or bring more housing downtown?
I think it's more about intentionality, right? Mm-hmm. Did the city of Louisville, did the administration go to Churchill Downs and say, hey, we know you're looking for a new headquarters and we want you to move downtown? Or did U of L do that? Answer is U of L did that. City of Louisville didn't, right?
Yeah.
So it's about being intentional about what you want.
That's fair.
Yeah, I can understand that. Another thing that we wanted to talk about, homelessness is obviously a major issue right now. It's a growing issue in many cities. And at least in my experience, it can oftentimes be prevalent in Louisville, especially the downtown area. And it can have a myriad of, you know, knock-on effects. Do you or the Metro Council have a plan for addressing this issue in our city?
Yeah, you know, we've been talking to the administration about several issues related to homelessness. And so one of the issues that we recently voted on was to spend roughly about $300,000. We did this probably 4 weeks ago, and we entered into a contract with the University of Louisville to conduct a study to find out how we can best implement a program in which we deflect police services. And what I mean by that is, I think everybody's familiar with First and Broadway at the Thornton's there and the large homeless population that is congregating around that area. So if you are the owner of that store, that Thornton's there, and that's what's going on your property, all around your property, it's hard to do business. And so you are constantly calling the police to come and deal with Joe, right? Joe is in the parking lot again, and he's homeless, and he's harassing the customers, okay? And so Joe also has a mental health problem. So why is Joe harassing customers? It's because he has a mental health problem. And so we send the police there, and that's the only tool that Metro government has to send to deal with an issue with Joe. And so we need a better response than that. And that better response is a mental health specialist or a social worker to deal with Joe. And so how we actually do that, whether you're talking about the model of the CAHOOTS program or the STAR program out of Colorado, what resources we have here in Louisville to put that all together with is what that study is for. And so once we figure out the better way to deal with Joe, instead of arresting him and putting him in jail, which does absolutely no good, it just relieves the problem for a couple hours. And so that's not really the answer. And so we need to get to the root cause of the problem. The root cause of the problem is the mental health that Joe has. And so addressing that and following those cases through is very important. And so I think that's one of those ways to do that. Another thing that we've been talking about and I've been pushing for is that I think that the city of Louisville should purchase an old hotel and staff it with people to work with the homeless and allow for them to have a place to be, a place to live. And that way that they're not having to live on the streets and under underpasses and on sidewalks. And so those are some of the thoughts that I have as it relates to that.
No, I think that's a very complete answer. And I'm glad we haven't gotten to the topic yet in this interview, but, you know, making sure you have the right people in the right positions to communicate, interact. You know, police often get asked to do too many things. So it's great to see that you can have maybe more social workers working with the homeless and getting them, you know, people that are trained to work in that specific area. And the housing component of it, to me, makes a lot of sense. But I actually want to change gears a little bit to talk a little bit about partisanship that I think you were actually in the news recently in that, like, partisanship is becoming, you know, a larger factor in politics, both, you know, in terms of possibly a nonpartisan mayoral race, mm-hmm. and the general just nationalization of elections for positions that aren't related to DC at all.
Right.
What are your thoughts kind of on the issue of partisanship? And do you think nonpartisan elections either stymie the growing nationalism of politics or feed it?
So, you know, the local discussion about partisanship as it was originally presented in House Bill 309 by Representatives Jerry Miller and Representative Jason Nemus in Frankfort was for the mayor's position to be a nonpartisan position. Doing so would have meant that Louisville, Kentucky would have been the only city in the entire country of the United States that would have had a nonpartisan mayor with a partisan council, which is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my response to that is, if it's so great to have nonpartisan races and positions, then we should do that for the whole state. Let's do it with the governor's position and the state House of Representatives and the state Senate. And let's go down that path. But they're not going to want to do that. That was simply about control and wanting to create opportunities for the Republican Party to take over the city of Louisville. And so that's my response to that.
Well, I think I personally may agree with you on that one. But Councilman, I want to turn for a second to talk about you. We know you've announced your campaign for Louisville mayor. Is there a specific reason or issue that prompted you to get involved and join that race?
Yeah, I just I would just simply say that, you know, I've been involved in government for well over 30 years, right? I joined the Louisville Police Department in 1984. And so I've seen, experienced, worked with many mayors, many council members, many aldermen, many commissioners, and seen everything that's taken place. And right now, I would say that the truck is in the ditch and the wheels are buried up to the axles in the mud for the city of Louisville. And we have got to get the truck out of the ditch. And so I think that I've got the experience, knowledge, know-how to get the truck out of the ditch, to get our city going again. And so that's why I threw my hat in the ring.
So do you think that being both a former police officer and a member of the Black community will help you in any way bridge the divisiveness that we've seen between those two groups over the last couple of years?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I am Black and I was a police officer for a long time. And so I think that the 30 years of being a police officer and, you know, working as a legislator in metro government for the last 10 years gives me a pretty unique perspective on relationships with the Black community and policing and its citizens. And so unless we acknowledge that issue exists and the history of policing as it relates to people of color and Blacks in America, then it's hard to move forward. We won't. And so we've got to acknowledge it. We've got to recognize it. And then we have to find ways to work together to build trust between the citizens and the police department and the government itself, and then move forward. Without doing that, we're just going to be stuck in the mud, as I said. And so I think it's vitally important that we learn to talk to one another, express our frustrations, and create some empathy and understanding and co-produce public safety in our city. And I think that's the only way we can go forward.
Well, and to that, one thing that I think we hear, I don't know if it's rhetoric or if it's an actual practice, but we hear the term community policing a lot. Is that something, what is that? And then how does that differ from traditional policing? And do you think that's something you would want your potential administration to move towards?
So what I would say to you about community policing is not a program. It's just simply good policing. And it's something that police departments should already be doing. It's something that the city should already be doing. And I don't believe in necessarily community-oriented policing. I believe in community-oriented government. And community-oriented government means the government, the police department, and everybody else works with the community to co-produce government, to make the government responsive to the citizens. And that's just how I feel about it. If anybody tells you that community-oriented policing is a program, they don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Well, fair enough. I guess I want to talk more about Louisville generally. I know at times since I've lived here, it seemed that the city can be maybe married to the current status quo. What would be your top executive priority in terms of trying to drive change throughout the city?
I think that one of the things that is real important for the executive of the city of Louisville is to be a cheerleader for the city of Louisville, all right? And to be accessible to its citizens and to its employees and to have a level of expectation amongst its employees and a level of accountability. And it's something that's been missing for many years now. And so I think that it's very, very important that that takes place. I also think it's very important that the executive branch of the city communicates with the citizens in a way to fulfill the desires of the citizens. And what I mean by that is the citizens have certain expectations of government. I think they expect government to not always be perfect, but I think when government messes up and makes mistakes, the government should acknowledge that. And over the last 10 years, I've not seen that very often. Actually, I've only seen it once. And so I think that that's very important. But as far as how we move our city forward and lift it up, I think that we have to have goals, and we establish those goals to the citizens, and we listen to the citizens. And we remember when I talked earlier about Nashville, right? That's what they did 14 years ago, right? And look where they are now. And that's the same thing we need to do here. It's not rocket science. And so it's simply a matter of working with our community, setting goals and sticking to those goals and giving regular reports of where we are in achieving those goals. And when we fail, say we failed and adjust and move forward again.
Yeah, I think that's something that's been clear, is everybody's been yearning for, you know, honesty and transparency from their local government for a long time, regardless of what city or state it's in. I think that's just become a growing desire of people throughout the country. But let's, again, a little bit of a follow-up to that. I know it will likely be a crowded primary for the mayoral election, but just imagining far into the future, if you do win, what would you hope that your mayoral legacy would be?
Oh, I think that if that were to happen, and looking back years, I think they'd say, well, I would like for people to say, well, he got the truck out of the ditch. He got us back to where we needed to be. And he made government actually transparent. And he actually listened to the citizens. He made government accessible. He held people accountable. And he helped get Louisville back on track.
Fair enough. Well, I appreciate the candidness with that. We are we're wrapping up here. So we do like to give people a chance to promote anything, any side projects or anything that they're working on. So the floor is yours if you want to promote anything.
No, I don't really have anything I want to promote. I just simply say that, you know, I recognize that there's a lot of stress on our government right now. There's a lot of stress on our citizens right now. And we've got COVID fever, and we've got civil unrest, and all that's going on at the same time. And you know, there's been a gap in leadership, right? And so I think that it's important that we acknowledge that, recognize it, and know that we're going to move forward. And it may not feel good right now, but it will. We will get there. And we just got to love each other more, and we've got to hold our government accountable, and we have got to move forward, and we will move forward. And with that, go Cards.
I like that. Well, Councilman, before we can let you go, we do like to ask all of our guests this final question. If you had the power to change a single policy in Louisville, just snap your fingers and make it happen, what would it be?
I don't know if I could say simply for Louisville. I think it would also have to include the state of Kentucky. And with that, I would say that the taxing structure for the city of Louisville and the state of Kentucky is just so outdated. It's very difficult to move things forward. And without that flexibility and ability to do that, I don't know that we can make a tremendous amount of progress when we talk about competing against other states and other cities.
Yeah, I completely understand that. You know, Oklahoma City made massive strides once they, you know, opted into their local option sales tax. So
yeah,
I completely understand where you're coming from with that. So, well, Councilman James, we thoroughly and very much appreciate you hopping on this podcast.
Yeah. And good luck in the upcoming election.
Well, thank you so much, guys. I hope you guys have a great day.
Yeah, absolutely. You too.
We'll pick back up with our reaction segment after a word from our sponsor.
That was another great interview with the president of Metro Council, David James. What did you think of the interview?
I mean, I thought it was great. I really appreciate him taking the time to speak with us. What was it that stood out to you, though?
Yeah, the first thing that I want to address is the roads that go through downtown. The state still has tons of control over it. I am glad that Councilman James has the relationship that he does with the state of Kentucky transportation cabinet. But it's still an unfair system, right? Because we are stuck within the confines of having to get state approval for literally every project we do, it still inhibits the ability to make Louisville as walkable, as connected, and as accessible as possible, because we just have to go through another level of bureaucratic red tape. And the other issue is, and it's just because of the philosophy of, I think, the state of Kentucky generally, the Department of Transportation still focuses on highways more than it focuses on urban development as far as roads. And they really only let Louisville – well, I don't want to say they only let Louisville. Louisville typically gets its projects when it's providing the funds itself, and then the state approves it. And that's what's happening with Nulu right now, is that Louisville is taking – unearthing their 2014 plans to redevelop Nulu's streetscape on Market – and they're paying for it. And so the state's going to okay it.
Yeah, it is just a weird tension. You know, you wouldn't expect to see or to need that kind of approval. I think the average citizen maybe doesn't know that that's the current situation, that the permitting or approval process needs to be run through the Department of Transportation. And you could imagine a scenario where if we were given autonomy over our own roads, that the Department of Transportation would have extra resources and extra energy, time to pour into other projects, you know, that might benefit the state.
Well, but that would also mean, though, that Louisville would probably be getting more tax revenue from the state, too. It's that the tax revenue is more centralized through the state because of the fact that they own the roads. So they're charged with maintaining it. So they get the tax dollars for those roads.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
But I get it. Like, Councilman James has to have that relationship with the state in order for it to work and successfully redevelop what we can, because that's the world we live in Kentucky. And I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was definitely good to hear that he didn't view it as a problem. And I can only imagine the reason that he hasn't viewed it as a problem is because they do have such a good working relationship, and in any project he's been involved in, he hasn't run into any issues in getting approval. But it still is just a weird hoop to jump through.
Well, and he may not have had issues. I will say, I think that the relationship period, or the hierarchy period, has slowed Louisville's growth as far as development of its roadways. And I don't think there's any way around.
Yeah.
The other thing that I thought was interesting too was his conversation about downtown. And obviously every downtown's getting hit because of COVID. But I thought it was interesting how he talked about how the city needs to start courting its businesses to go downtown. So like he took Churchill Downs, for example, and that's the fact that Louisville courted them to go out to that location and that the city really didn't. I'm curious how effective the city government could be to get them to move downtown to property that they do not own, right?
Yeah,
they
would have some kind of tax or you know, tax break or grant incentive, right? Is the only thing I could picture.
Yeah, it's a lot easier for U of L at their Shelbyville campus to go, hey, we have this plot, we'll try and do the development or however that went down, and say, we'll build your office right here.
Yeah.
Versus the city going, okay, well, here's all these parking lots downtown. Try and pick the private owner and build at that location.
Yeah.
And there would have to be tax incentives. And I don't want to go into the tax incentives for a second too with that. I think, you know, there was some, you know, maybe some uproar with that project that's potentially going in across the street from the Slugger Museum of, like, I don't know, 5, 6, 8 story condo building. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that, well, if there's tax subsidies for that, it's $1 million over 10 years. People are like, well, why are we putting so much money in those subsidies? Well, two things. One, if they're only paying $50,000 a year in tax
currently,
you're not really giving those incentives. Like, you're not really paying $1 million. You're just not taking the $50,000. So you have to look at the tax revenue that you would be missing out on currently, which would be like $50,000 a year versus, and I don't know that these numbers are not exact, so don't quote me on those numbers. But like, that's the point, is that you have to look at like what the rate is now and see what it would be over the course of 5-10 years, however long that the tax incentives are. And instead of just looking at the whole number of the quote unquote value, because the break is once the building's there and taxed at its new assessed value.
Yeah. Once the project is complete and the subsidy is expired, then you assume your tax revenue is going to be so substantially greater that it's going to pay for itself plus.
So. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that, I guess that's the other issue too, is Louisville. Louisville's not Nashville. Once you have a downtown that's growing and growing quickly enough, it becomes self-fulfilling and it's cyclical in that, like, oh, because there are businesses down here, more people want to build. And it just continually evolves and evolves and evolves. And everyone wants to be down there because that's where the infrastructure is. That's where the business development is. But you can't get to that point until you have that nucleus. And Louisville's getting a lot closer, but we're still not a city that can't get apartment complexes or condos or anything downtown, really, without getting a lot of incentives. It's just we're just not there yet.
Yeah, and I think that feeds into the more traditional view of growing an urban core, that the idea of bringing in major businesses is, I think, kind of unique in that most people talk about like increasing housing density and getting people into that.
And that's core. Absolutely integral too.
Yeah. Oh no. Yeah. It's two sides of like the same coin. You want to see both of those to, grow and revitalize that urban core. But no, it was good to hear that. I think the councilman had an idea of wanting to get businesses down there. And, you know, you've already quoted at least one project, housing project, that is going up in the downtown area. We just have to see how it develops over the next few years, I guess.
Yeah. And I just, it's just interesting to see. I just don't know what the role of Metro Council or the mayor could be in that, in courting people downtown, other than tax incentives. And that was kind of my whole point there. It's just, I don't know what that role, what that looks like, other than just having a conversation and trying to make connections. But I know, from talking to Metro councilors myself, is that they don't own those properties. They can try and connect people all the time, but that doesn't mean that the projects they want are going to go in those locations. It's a very difficult thing to develop any area of town from a Metro government perspective, because they just don't own the property.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And then the other thing that I thought was really important too is the partisan races. He's been one of the more vocal people on it. And I actually,
he definitely didn't split any hairs when he was talking about it today.
Right.
He thinks it was essentially a power grab by the Republicans.
Yeah. And I think actually someone that did a great job breaking this down is Chris Ottz over at the Uncovered podcast from WDRB. He sat down with Jerry Miller, the representative trying to actually push this bill.
Yeah, one of the authors.
And I think that was a great interview explaining it too. But it doesn't really seem like it's beneficial to anybody in Louisville at this point. As a personal philosophy, I like things being nonpartisan if everything was nonpartisan, but that's not the way the world works.
Exactly. And that kind of destroys their argument, you know, in pushing that legislation. If you're going to apply it to one specific race where Democrats have traditionally held power, why would you not expand it statewide? Or why is it specific?
But why is it not tailored? Affecting Metro Council? Like, that's the part that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's a weird construction of the law that seems pretty obviously partisan in nature. You know?
Agreed. But yeah, so those are some things that stood out to me. What stood out to you?
I honestly really liked the discussion of homelessness. Although it was kind of brief, mm-hmm. I thought the proposal to purchase a hotel to kind of offset some of the most dramatic experiences of homelessness to provide shelter for these people and have the Metro government take a more frontline role. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. And I think that portion is so complex.
Yeah.
That he did seem to take it from a better angle than most. And I think Metro Louisville is starting to take better stances towards homelessness. It's improved. I mean, they had the camp clearing ordinance a couple of years ago that was passed that kind of gave more notice, more delays into clearing encampments. But even with recently with Derby, I think I saw Ja'Cory Arthur put something out about how the council has pushed to actually have it, these spaces be cleaned and not
well,
removed.
For people that maybe don't know, the article broke a few days ago that police in preparation for the Derby were maybe going to clear out the homeless areas around downtown Louisville and try and, I think.
Well, it hasn't just been police before either, to be clear. It's been Metro Council worker, or not Metro Louisville workers.
Yeah, absolutely. But the city was going to make an effort to clear out the homeless encampments around the city in preparation for the Derby, mm-hmm. which, seemed problematic, to say the least. And as you said, Jacory Arthur
pushed that out. And it's the idea that they cited CDC guidelines, right? Is that it is better to sanitize. And when you disperse people, it actually pushes the spread of disease. So in the middle of COVID, in the middle of a pandemic, it doesn't make sense to kind of disperse people and potentially spread COVID, especially when you're having another international event here. So I think you're starting to see some steps like that become better. But I do think that there was a little bit of a generalization by Councilman James about the mental health of homelessness. Again, like, this is a very complex issue, and I hope we can have someone that's an expert on it, because I'm certainly not. But there's tiers to it, right?
We don't want to categorize all homelessness. I think the type of homelessness we're talking about right now is chronic, you know, the worst experience of homelessness. But you've also got kind of transitional or episodic homelessness between jobs, people couch surfing. Those are technically, you know, experiences with homelessness, but they aren't what people generally think of when, you know, the discussion comes up.
Yeah. And I think that's the importance of why you have to start getting social workers involved, like, more and more. And any time that there's that interaction, the people that can help are the ones that can connect them to resources.
Absolutely.
Right. Just moving them doesn't solve the issue. And providing housing. I mean, we were just talking about this, right? With subsidies and trying to get more urban housing. Literally, the housing market in Louisville, or I guess across the country, is on fire right now.
No question.
And part of that is because there's a dearth of affordable housing.
Housing density needs to increase, I think, nationwide. Like, urban centers have seen a lot of pushback from the community to try and do away with, you know, single family zoning or upzone to allow for higher density, which would hopefully incentivize, you know, more building supply. And if you can increase the housing and the building supply, then maybe you can start to address some of the, you know, the homelessness issues.
Well, you've got to start making the housing affordable, and that you have to be making 1 to 2 bedroom apartments. Like, that is a big, or condos. That's a big part of it. They can't be 3 to 4 bedroom luxury apartments or condos. Like, that's not a sustainable way forward at this point.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I honestly, we touched on police involvement with the homeless issue here in Louisville, but I wanted to actually talk more about policing in general. And I think we had a discussion about community policing in the interview, and I don't know that we did a good enough job trying to define that. Councilman James was adamant that community policing isn't necessarily a program. And that's absolutely true. But community policing is really a set of principles or ideals that a police force should operate under. And this feeds really well into the white paper for this week, which is titled "Reevaluating Community Policing in a Polycentric System." And the article, it talks about community policing efforts, which kind of sprung up in the 1980s. And I think the best way to think about it is community policing tries to create a relationship, a closer relationship between the community that they serve and the police officers themselves. So common examples you see within community policing are things like foot patrols or bike patrols that take police officers out of their cruisers and put them more directly into the community so that people can kind of build ties, you know, like just naturally seeing these people every day. You're going to familiarize yourself with them in a way that you might not if they're stuck in a police car, you know, or even kind of community events that police officers are kind of incentivized to attend.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And again, the idea here isn't that community policing is a specific policy, but it's that idea of creating more interaction rather than having the appearance of a hierarchy or a subservience to the police force. So I think one example that I've had since undergrad is my professor, who was from Great Britain, said to me that one of the biggest mistakes that America ever made was putting police officers in the police car. Because what it does is it separates the police from the rest of the community. So that's why, you know, in my entire career, I've always pushed for police officers to be standing, to be on bikes, to be on those trikes, whatever they're called, the almost like
segues.
Yeah, exactly. Because what it does is it puts them on the same field as individuals.
Yeah, you could imagine yourself having a conversation with the guy walking down the street, a cop walking down the street. You're not going to flag a cop down in his patrol car and, you know, talk to him.
Yeah,
that you know, you're not going to build a relationship or rapport with somebody that's simply driving through your neighborhood.
Yeah, you want them to be members of the community just like everyone, yeah. Every other profession.
And certainly, like, the ideals go beyond just foot patrols, although I think that is kind of one of the more prominent examples you see executed. But it's things like police being at, you know, public events, like attending, you know, a community like organizing.
Like a coffee with a cop or a cookout with a cop, those types
of ideas. See these types of programs, you know. And the last thing that I think is commonly discussed when talking about community-oriented policing is having police responses be at the community level. You want them to be really tailor fit to the communities that these police officers serve. And that's really the meat of the article today, is talking about a tension that it kind of exists in policing. And to quote the paper, federal policy over the last 30 years has subsidized local police involvement in federally based anti-drug and anti-terrorism initiatives, resulting in a set of perverse incentives that's directed efforts of local policing agencies away from community safety and towards different objectives. So what that's saying is basically at the federal level, there are a lot of incentives, both economic and legal, that have drawn police efforts away from community activities towards more federally based crimes like drug and terrorism related. So kind of in cooperation with
like the war agencies. On drugs.
The war on drugs is a great example. Yeah. And honestly, there is an economic incentive in some of these as community police forces might gain some percent of whatever is seized through civil asset forfeiture, you know, and so there's an economic incentive to seek out those drugs or to pour resources into policing those types of crimes, you know, and those are types of crimes that involve more often than not SWAT teams, you know, like a more militarized version of the police force. And so you've seen between 1980 and 1995, there was a fivefold increase in the deployment of SWAT teams, you know, and it's hard to build a community, a sense of community with a group of people that look like soldiers, you know, like an occupying force.
Well, I think the point you're getting at here is that there's not a clear delineation, and that like the militarization of specific groups has increased the militarization across the board. So just because there's a SWAT team to focus on drugs, we're not even getting into the fact of the fact that the war on drugs and things like that targeted minorities.
Yeah,
absolutely. But beyond that fact, we're just talking about the fact that the top tier group of aggression in the police force was given more militaristic weapons, and that raised the floor. So now there's more highly armed police officers across the board.
Absolutely. And within these police forces, there are kind of dual and adversarial incentives. You know, you want to build community trust through community policing, but you also have these other incentives that push you towards that more militaristic approach and more heavily policing federal crimes, you know? And so it's just a weird dichotomy. When we see over recent years, a lot of people pushing for police reform, a lot of the reforms that they are advocating are things that fit neatly into this idea of community policing, you know?
And I think that's the point we kind of brought up with the homelessness with Councilman James, is that we can't have the police covering large areas of the law. Like, you can't have them be enforcing homelessness and trying to act as social workers, and then also those same people working to try and bust drug crimes in the communities. But like, you can't have that huge spectrum. You have to have people specifically focused on those areas.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've seen an increase in programs that will partner a police officer with a social worker, you know, to try and maybe lead with the social worker to on things that police might get the call on, but it's not really in their realm of expertise. You know, mm-hmm. it is something that requires a social worker. And so programs like that, we've seen a significant increase in recent years. And I think it's maybe too early to draw substantial conclusions from that data. But in the coming few years, I would hope that there is a severe focus on those types of activities to see if they do benefit the community at large.
Yeah. And I do want to just kind of point out too, this is not our policing podcast either. I think that might be something that we hit on in the future, but this is just like more of a generalized topic that hopefully we can have someone with an expertise kind of delve into this topic a little bit more. But with that said, do you have anything else to add before we sign off?
No, I think we can wrap it up. Thanks for tuning in, guys.
Yeah, thanks.
As always, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for joining us on Building This Community. If you'd like any more information, you can follow us on Twitter at buildingthiscom.com, or you can follow Andrew
at Andrew J. Klump, and you can also follow Luke
at LMP43. Definitely subscribe, and we look forward to talking to you guys next week.